Thank you, Samira. Thank you, Nick. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you for inviting me. The reason for pedospheric process and climate change is the fact that carbon is one of the most important element in the Earth. The units here are 10 to the 18 gram. Earth mantle contains 22 ton, 10 to the 4. Total carbon, the rocks, which is the carbonates, 60 ton, 10 to the 4 exagram. The organic, which is the fossil fuel component, out of 15, about 4 or so is fossil fuel proven reserves. Ocean, 42. Soils, 4 to 3 meter depth. Atmosphere, 0.8, 800 petagram. Biosphere, 0.6. This table indicates two points which are very important to recognize, that sea is the fourth most abundant element in the universe, after hydrogen, helium, and oxygen. And the second, and that's really more important, and that is that there is extremely little CO2 in the atmosphere, as you can see from here, 0.8, compared to the in the rocks and ocean. Thus, if inputs and outputs are not closely balanced, atmosphere is easily overwhelmed. And that's exactly what has happened since 1750. We have overwhelmed the atmosphere by using fossil fuel combustions and deforestation. And that's a very important part to recognize. This is not the most recent. There is a recent decadal global carbon budget. But the point I want to emphasize here is that from the sources and total source, let's see here about 7, here about almost 8, here almost 9, currently more than 10. Almost 55 to 60% of what is emitted by human activities is absorbed by the ocean and the land sinks, both known and unknown, about 55 to 60%. In fact, contrary to what the previous concern was, that ocean and land sinks are decreasing, at the present at least, they are not. And if you look at, compare that with 1960s, the net global carbon uptake has indeed increased by about 0.05 gigaton of carbon per year since 1960. If you compare the global uptake, which has doubled from 2.4 gigaton in 1960 to about 5 gigaton in 2010. And that brings another question which is important, is to identify the mechanisms and locations responsible for increasing global carbon uptake in the terrestrial biosphere. And I think that's a very important research priority. Identify where and how that is happening, and is it possible that we can somehow manipulate that? And to be able to manipulate, we need to go back to those terrestrial biosphere carbon pool reservoir, biota, 620 gigaton atmosphere. This is the same data in the different units, 800 gigaton, increasing about 4.3 gigaton per year. Ocean, 42. Remember, I had 42 times 10 to the 22. 42,000 gigaton, and of course the soil to 3 meter depth, as I indicated, 4, and that's 3,150 plus 750 inorganic carbon, that's approximately 4. Now the question is, what happens to the fluxes between them? One is the fossil fuel combustion, about 10, land use change about 1.6, going into the atmosphere, atmosphere absorbed, gross primary productivity 123 gigaton, some of it goes back in the atmosphere through plant respiration, some through into the soil, goes back in the atmosphere through salt respiration. Of course, the ocean and the atmosphere exchange somewhere between 1992, so we have a net positive gain. So that's kind of a detail, what I indicated a few moments ago, happening. Now, the climate has two distinct components. One, of course, is the atmosphere and its chemistry. One, the hydrosphere and its dynamics. And this climate component strongly interacts with the pedosphere. The pedosphere has several processes, biogeochemical transformations, obviously quite a very important one. Of course, the soil organic carbon pool and its dynamics, which are related to the biogeochemical transformations, and several other pedospheric processes, the nutrient cycling, the water cycling, the biotic processes, which are many there. This pedosphere, which the top 1, 2, 3 meters of that, of course, is linked with the parent material, which we call the lithosphere. And lithosphere has its own processes, fossil fuel combustion and its dynamics since millions of years ago, which we are now exploiting and influencing the climate, is one. Of course, this all inorganic carbon pool is another one. And there are many other processes within that that also interact within the lithosphere. And both the lithospheric and pedospheric processes, in fact, interact very closely and influence the atmosphere and the biosphere. And we as a soil scientists really need to work with our geological colleagues to understand those lithospheric processes. For example, if we take at the lithospheric processes, which are very important to climate change, weathering, leaching, alleviation, the soil organic carbon dynamics. I had the word humification there, but I changed it this morning because I realized the word humus is being questioned these days. Mineralization, and of course the geologic erosion, which is part of the weathering. Then these processes influence the soil quality. That has impact on the hydrologic and energy balance, the gaseous fluxes emissions, the elemental transformations. And these things together influence the biosphere considerably in terms of the biodiversity, in terms of the biomass ecosystem components, net primary productivity, net ecosystem or net biome productivity. And this leads us back to the original diagram that I had. How can the net primary productivity be influenced with significant impact on the climate? For example, the gross primary productivity, you remember the arrow I had, 123 gigaton of carbon per year. The net primary productivity is 60 going back to through plant respiration. Net ecosystem productivity, 10. Net biome productivity, that stays back, about 3. Imagine if that 3 can be maintained in the terrestrial biosphere year after year. But that doesn't happen. That 3 is lost. Also imagine if this 123 component can be somehow increased, perhaps to the CO2 fertilization effect or to improvement in the water and nutrient dynamics. So I think the important part that I would like to indicate is that only 0.05% of 3800 gigajoules of solar energy is absorbed annually by GPP. Very small, very inefficient if you want to put it that way. Somehow can that be managed through soil and plant ecosystem? More importantly, perhaps if we control what plants do with carbon, the fate of CO2 in the atmosphere is in our hands. I think that's a very important part to recognize, that somehow we can manage this. That would be first priority of low-hanging fruit than looking at the geologic sequestration. So the idea is to put the carbon back in the soil from the atmosphere, and while doing so, we improve biodiversity, we improve feed security, we include adaptation and mitigation of climate change, water resources. Hopefully we can do that through some kind of world soil policy. And I think the UN summit about a month ago or so was a very step in the right direction. So how does this carbon sequestration can happen? Of course, there is inorganic carbonates, which are very important. Inorganic carbonates have two possible reactions. Under reduced conditions, under the high soil moisture condition, perhaps ferric carbonates, Fe2, through reduction of Fe3 under reduced condition, but the process is impeded in the presence of H2S, leading to formation of FeS and FeS2, the pyrite, or under xeric conditions, as the picture on the right side here, which is the secondary carbonates or pedogenic carbonates, the formation of pedogenic carbonates with calcium and magnesium sodium when carbon is supplied from outside the ecosystems. So that's one part. I think the rate of carbonate carbon sequestration is very low, maybe as low as 2, 3, 4, 5 kilograms of carbon per hectare per year, but the area is very large, almost as much as 4 billion hectares under arid and semi-arid climates. Now, in terms of the organic carbon, there is a concept of nutrient requirements. We have crop residues. Somehow this residue, through biogeochemical transformations, require additional nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, and other nutrients to convert that into soil organic carbon. The reason those additional nutrients are required, because of the elemental ratio in cereal residue, carbon to nitrogen 100, in soil organic carbon 12 or 10 or 15. The carbon to phosphorus ratio, maybe it's in cereal 200, in soil organic carbon about 50. Carbon to sulfur ratio 500 to 70. Therefore, additional nutrients in addition to plant requirements are needed to convert the crop residue carbon into humus or into soil organic carbon. How much? Here is an example. Let's say that we want to sequester 10,000 kilograms of biomass carbon as soil organic carbon. What kind of nutrients do we require? 833 kilogram nitrogen using the ratio that I just gave you a few minutes ago. 200 kilogram of phosphorus. Another 143 kilogram of sulfur. This will lead to about 228,000 kilogram of carbon in residue. And if there's a 30% or so of efficiency, you require about 62,000 kilogram of residue to convert everything, all this recipe together, into 10,000 kilogram of humus, which will produce 17,241 kilogram of humus. The question is it free? Chicago Climate Exchange collapsed 10 cents a ton of CO2. This really requires quite a lot of input. And that input, if you want to incentivize farmers to adopt this policy, there is a lot of input required, and unless the price of hay, the price of nutrients, the price of everything, there's an article coming out that I just wrote for General Soil and Water Conservation coming currently. You will see the calculation based on this, what the price societal value of soil carbon is on the basis of these inputs. The question remains, even if we are able to do it, if we do not keep it in the soil, if it's reoxidized immediately, that does no good to anybody. Therefore, increasing mean residence time of that carbon in soil is very critical. After you get in the soil, keep it there. So somehow we need to, and the mean residence time changes from seconds to millennia. It is only the soil organic carbon with a long mean residence time of decades to millennia that really can influence the climate change. And the environmental and biological control rather than the molecular structure. I think it's a physical separation that people are these days talking about. So there are several mechanisms. One is selective preservation. Primary recalcitrance versus secondary recalcitrance. The second mechanism is spatial inaccessibility. So somehow the organic matter content is not accessible to microorganisms, either through occlusion, through aggregation, through hydrophobicity, perhaps phyllosilicates, encapsulation within the macromolecules, or interaction with matter surfaces, clay, polyvalent cations, metal complexation, weak interaction. Somewhere we have to understand these mechanisms, how can we increase these, and I'm going to discuss a few of these with you, whether it's weathering, leaching, aggregation formation, erosion, mineralization, elemental cycling are very important. Weathering, for example, silicates, calcium and magnesium silicates, when they react with CO2 over a long time scale, long horizon, we call this Urey reaction, obviously is very important to long-term transport of carbon from land into the ocean. A long-term weathering reaction in the long run, total or overall reaction, really is taking CO2, reacting with calcium aluminium silicates and precipitating calcium carbonates. Over a long time scale, the plant-modified weathering of calcium magnesium silicate really is, over a millennial scale, an important atmospheric CO2 sink. The second part is how the biotic reactions in soil can be very important. Soil is really, I would like to define it as an organic carbon-mediated realm in which the solid, liquid, gas, and biology all interact from a scale of nanometer to a landscape scale. I think that if we recognize that, the biota is a very important component of the entire carbon cycle, and that part has to be understood. A spade of rich garden soil may harbor more species than the entire Amazon nurtures above ground. A teaspoon of productive soil contains 100 million to 1 billion microorganisms. As you know, the penicillin originally came from soil. This is probably the best way I could depict a real soil tilt and soil structure and matched by plant roots and carbon mixed into it, what should look like. And once we do the extractive farming, we obviously mine that out and deplete the carbon pool, which we have completed in terms of the emission back in the atmosphere. So if we somehow can have those organic matter linking the clay particles together, and then also perhaps linking with the metallic cations, forming these organo-mineral complexes, and we can encapsulate this within these aggregates that I showed a moment ago, and this is the closer up of that structure. If we can manipulate that and manage it and create a clay polyvalent cation sol organic matter complex, which we call as microaggregates, and if several of these microaggregates join together to make microaggregates, and I think Tidsdale and group from Australia also felt that perhaps sometime a macroaggregate is formed first and then the microaggregate in between, the so-called hierarchy theory. One way or the other, this is the mechanism by which the soil carbon can be stored in a cold storage for a long period of time, so it's inaccessible to microorganisms and can stay there for centuries or millennia. Several models exist, clay particles or silt-sized particles, and clay there in forms of domains, and then having organic matter linking in different formations to cement that particles together to form a stable aggregate which really encapsulates the carbon in them and make it completely inaccessible. Here is another model of that, where you got microaggregates cemented together by X, which are the carbon, and that carbon is really locked from a long time period and not accessible. Now, when the erosion happened, that's just the reverse of it. Those aggregates are disrupted, the carbon is released, and as it is released, it becomes more accessible to microorganisms. It can be decomposed back in the atmosphere. Over a landscape scale, the carbon may be moving from here into the depressional sites and eventually transform into the stream, and over this long-term period en route, change in the aggregate structure, collapse of those aggregates, in my opinion, that is a major source of carbon to the atmosphere. If it's an oxidized condition, CO2, if it's a reduced condition, it might be methane. But the reason I'm pointing it out is because there is another opinion that carbon that is being taken to the stream is really a sequestration. I don't want to go into the definition of whether it's a sequestration or not, but the fact is that we got to look at the erosion from a point of view of a total watershed scale process. For example, if you take the soil carbon pool on a global scale to 1 meter depth, now I'm to 1 meter, not 3 meter, we got about 1500 gigaton. Erosion-induced transport of that carbon, considering it 2-3% in the sediments preferential removal because of the high enrichment ratio, is roughly 5-6 gigaton. Out of this 5-6 gigaton, about 4 gigaton is redistributed over the landscape. But almost 0.7 gigaton or 0.6 gigaton is taken back to the ocean, perhaps buried there. Yes, I can understand this goes out of circulation. But for this to happen, almost a double of that goes in the atmosphere. And none of this model currently, any model, takes that erosion-induced carbon emission into consideration. And therefore, that's incomplete. It's not a real story of what happens to the carbon on a global scale. So, what are the soils with more carbon sink capacity? There are several types of soils. Example of such soils are chernozems. This is from Moldova, a colleague Boris, vertisols. Vertisols have a capacity to store and more. Soils, umbrisols, UNESCO classification. I couldn't find a very good example of an endosol. So I got that picture the last night. Remember, we had a volcano in Hawaii. So eventually this will become an endosol. I just wanted to show you that's an example. That was last night. Humic latosols from Brazil, Terra Rosa soils are very, very, very important in terms of sink. The technosol, the soils which are modified by human being. Tara Prota de Indio, Johan Lehman colleagues are talking about biochar, the anthrosol, the soils influenced by urban soils, really tremendously modified, have a lot of potential if they are managed properly. Artificial soil, making soils from waste and biomass. The other part which I think is very important for us to consider in terms of the long term is permafrost, the cryosol, the jelly soils. We have recent estimate that rather than 400 gigaton, these soils perhaps contain as much as 1500 or 1600 gigaton of carbon. Imagine if that carbon got thawed, we really have a serious problem at our hand. So I think one of the parts we've got to think about is this. I think with that background on how the mean residence time can be increased through principle and processes of phytosphere, I want to say a few words about sustainable soil management in relation to carbon. It means replace what is removed. We are always talking about taking 1 billion tons of crop residue and do whatever we're going to do with it, biofuel and so forth. It's very important to replace whatever is removed from soil, respond wisely to what is changed, and be able to predict what may happen by anthropogenic and other natural perturbations. There is a critical level of carbon in soil below which the pedospheric processes are jeopardized. That concentration may be 2%, maybe 1.5%, but it's not 0.05% or 0.01%, such as soils of South Asia and part of Sub-Saharan Africa. This example is from Argentina, where the wheat yield is increasing up to a certain level, and then it plateaus. And this example has been repeated many times. For example, the data from the literature that I compiled several years show that if you can increase soil organic carbon in the root zone by 1 ton, 1 microgram carbon per hectare, for same management, same fertilizer, same inputs, the corn yield can be increased by 100 to 300 kilograms, the soybean by 20 to 50, wheat, that Argentinian data about 20 to 70, sorghum about 80 to 140, millet, beans, etc. Soil carbon is really the engine. It's the engine of economic development quality. Samir, I put this for you, L. Exir. Now you can give me a couple of more minutes. Soil organic matter has, over the centuries, been considered by many as an elixir. Elixir is not an English word. It's Arabic, elixir. We anglicized it. But I want you to know people call organic matter as an elixir or elixir, a recipe of improving soil quality. A very important concept. Soils and men, SOM, soil organic matter, is one of our most important natural resources. And I won't read all of them except the last one. And this was Albrecht, president of the Soil Science Society of America in 1938. He said, health of our nation may be impossible to restore without first restoring the health of our soils. That's a very important statement made by him in 1938. My colleagues from Australia, especially Alex McBlatney, are very enthused about soil security, and I would like to share his views with you that soil quality indeed is important to water security, energy security. But I think more important at the end, this is what was Albrecht saying in 1938, that national security and political stability also depends on that. A paradigm of mutual respect based on ecological integrity and symbiotic coexistence and anthropogenic exploitation can really lead to severe problems unless we replace what we remove. The last thing I want to mention is that the pedosphere in terms of quest for our survival involves understanding of pedospheric processes, recognizing the limits of its potential and challenges, pursuing relentlessly technology to optimize the ecosystem services, and improving soil organic carbon content and pool so that degraded soils can be restored. My last slide, and I hope I leave that a message for the Soil Science Society of America and, of course, the International Union of Soil Science. We here see many icons of climate change, whether it's a polar bear, whether it's a tortoise, whether it's a panda. The real icon of global change and human survival, we always miss out, really should be the pedosphere. That's the icon. I do not know how to present it in a way that everybody can use it. This is this thing that makes the world go around. These are the processes that keep the life cycle going and climate change happening. And I hope that we can adopt this cycle. Thank you.